you want. You can't always get what you want. But if you try sometimes, well, you might find.
Welcome to Visionaries. I'm John LaBelle, your host. You'll find us here on PRN.FM, Mondays at 10 a.m. On Visionaries, we talk about creativity in the arts, science, technology, culture, and spirituality, and about how we can enrich the world and ourselves by tapping into the energies of the cosmos. Along the way, we talk with some of the most interesting visionaries in the world about our lives today and the tomorrows that they're creating. Our guest today is futurist designer Bill Katavalos, one of the most imaginative people I know, and we'll talk more about Bill and his background as we go through the show, but let's just open by imagining a room, and this room is totally empty, but we don't know that it's a very thick floor, and in that floor are buried huge tulip bulbs. And you want to sit down, and you signal you want to sit down, and this tulip bulb grows up into a chair, and you sit down in it. When you're done, it retreats back into the ground. So, Bill, tell us about organic architecture.
Well, you know, that started way back in 1948. I had an organic epiphany in those days. I came up with the 9 organic joints, and there was an organic competition at the Museum of Modern Art, and Charles Eames won. That's when he came up with the plywood chair. That was the first time. That was the winner. The 9 joints didn't make it. And I was, of course, excited by the way Eames worked. He was working with Tarrant at the time. And that changed furniture forever. And so I come from that period, and organicism, I began to think in new ways. I remember taking over Phil Pavia's old studio on Great Jones Street and experimenting with that stuff. And that's where that manifesto, Organics, came out of. Drexler saw it, took it to the Museum of Modern Art, and they had that visionary architecture show. Back in the...
Cool.
Yeah, that's how it began.
To this day, other project of Bill's, you can go to the Museum of Modern Art, look at the furniture department. The chairs there are always rotating, but occasionally you'll see Bill Katavalos's chairs. So Bill's got furniture in the Museum of Modern Art. He's a professor of architecture at Pratt Institute, where he's a colleague of mine. And just to give some hints about how old we are here, in 1963, I was a student at the University of Pennsylvania, and this really wild guy came to the school and talked about really far-out ideas. He said things like, in the future, the drug companies are going to control our lives. And today, they do. And he also said, next year's Cadillacs are going to lose the tail fins. And sure enough, they did. So Bill's always been an inspiration for me. And as we go along here, we'll talk about his glass house, his 200-plus mile high buildings, his water architecture, things like that. So, Bill, tell us about what the design world was like in the late 40s and early 50s, who you were involved with, and how it's similar to or different from today.
Well, the thing is, I don't know whether it's Cronkite or the other guy who called it the greatest generation, you know, you had a bunch of veterans that had 4 years. They had 4 years to think about what they wanted to do, whether they were in the Pacific or in Europe. They were a little busier, but... that's why we were different. We were much older. We had already begun to think about what we were going to do. And we went back, and our education was paid for. We went back and studied what we needed to know to do what we were thinking about. So we had a running start over the present generation, which is being, you know, they're being stopped by politics, really. We had a quantum leap, and we took advantage of it. I mean, this is where Eames came out of that. Saarinen came out of that. I mean, I remember Saarinen when he knew he had a brain tumor. You know, he knew he had to get out everything he wanted to do all at once. And it was marvelous to be with him, you know. Not only the Tech Center at General Motors, but the Arch and doing the
TWA.
And everything was coming out all at once. And he was a model for all of us. He was a he was one of the most game-changing architects we've ever had. It all happened. And I got involved with the Saarinen. I designed a lot of furniture for the Tech Center for him. He called me up one night and said, Bill, can you do a 35-foot long sofa? And I said, well, why not? And we brought it as personal luggage on the airplane. But he needed it. He needed it for an opening night. So that's the way we worked in those days. You don't do that today. I mean, it just doesn't happen that way anymore. No.
So I understand that you were in a race with Philip Johnson to do the first glass house. How did that, what was that all
that's
about?
That's right. I didn't know Johnson was doing a glass house. We talked the Kelly family up in Buffalo into doing a glass box up there right over the, just outside of Buffalo, over the Casanova, the river above the. Now, we didn't know what we were doing, but I went to the engineer at Pratt at that time, Bill McGinnis, and I said, Bill, this is what we're going to do. We're going to put up, 12 H columns, and then we're going to put in plate glass, and we're going to put in a new, and he looked at me and he said, in Buffalo? And I didn't take him too seriously. So I came back and I said, Bill, with the estimates we're getting are terrific. It doesn't cost anything to do this. And he said, let's wait and see. Well, we got the house halfway up and the family began to have financial problems and it was delayed. But what happened is that the house cost nothing, but we had to put in the telephone line, the sewer lines. I mean, we had to do, it cost three times more than the architecture. So it slowed the whole project down. And then someone told me about Johnson. So Ross and I drove to New Canaan, and he was very cordial. He was very nice to us. And, of course, I enjoyed his house very much. It's a beautiful house. And he said, if you think this is good, you ought to see the Farnsworth that's going up. So we drove all night to the Farnsworth out in Plano in Illinois. And we fortunately got there when that woman wasn't there. And the door was open.
Hang on. So that's Mies van der Rohe's glass house.
The Farnsworth house.
Yeah. Right.
That's a real glass house. That's a perfect place. But even he blew it with two ordinary bathrooms and a kitchen. I mean, he should have gone all the way. I mean, he should have... It bothered me. It even bothered me then when she was putting in all those closets and the rest of it. They weren't necessary. That stuff could have still happened. She was worried about privacy. Well, you know that if you light a glass house on the outside, no one can see, and it's a mirror. So nobody solved those problems. And Mies was caught up in litigation, and he lost interest in it.
So... Bill went on to do some other really imaginative stuff. One of the projects he was talking about when I was sitting in on his course at Pratt was a 200-mile-plus building. What's the thinking there? I mean, we're just breaking a mile now. This is a really quantum leap. What's the idea between...
Well, that's interesting. I don't know. I gave a lecture up at Rhode Island School of Design on the tall buildings. And there was a young girl there, Gloria Root, who asked me after the lecture that she had a scholarship to Aspen. And would I drive with her to Aspen? Now, that was a terribly interesting trip. I mean, it turned out that she was Hugh Hefner's favorite centerfold. I didn't know that at the time. But when we got to Aspen, she was an explosion. I mean, you know, Nelson and everybody wanted to know her. So I suddenly became important over there. And Murray Gell-Mann was giving a lecture. So to impress Gloria, I just stood up and said, now, Mr. Gell-Mann, could we build a 240-mile-high building, you know, and use the atomic waste in the basement, take it up in an elevator, and use the sun as a sewer? And Gell-Mann thought about it for a few minutes, and he said, no, of course you can. He said, of course, it would crush the mantle of the earth. And then there were a bunch of engineers in the room, and everybody got involved. And we spent the whole day designing half a dozen 240-mile-high buildings, and Gell-Mann was a critic for it. So that's how it happened.
Cool. I remember you saying that the International Space Station was checking out the roof, and then you'd start there and build down.
Well, that... you know, we had wild ideas. When this guy jumped from space a couple of years ago, I thought this was wonderful. That's the way we used to think in those days, you know. Why not? Why waste time? Just jump out and let's see what happens. I loved the way he left. He said, I'm going home. And he leaped into nothingness for half an hour. That's wonderful.
Cool. Yeah. So you mentioned Murray Gell-Mann. I gather that you encountered a gathering of physics out on Long Island at your parents' hotel, and it's led you to be thinking ever since about subatomic particles. So tell us about that.
Well, now that was in 47, after I'd gotten out of the war. Mentally, I was in bad shape. I mean, we were in the Philippines for a long time, and people don't realize that the Battle of Manila, the Battle of Luzon, was the second worst battle of the Second World War. We lost more people there than anywhere else. So I asked my father. He owned the Rem's Head Inn out on Rem Island, which is just off Shelter Island. I said, Dad, can I go out and spend the winter alone out there and paint and think? And he said, you're crazy, but you can do anything you want. So I did go out, and I did my best paintings out there on Transite. I was pouring paint the way Pollock does, but differently. I was pouring whole areas of paint, not dripping. And I woke up one morning, and it was surreal. Suddenly, this empty place was filled with faces that I had known from photographs. I mean, who the hell doesn't know Oppenheimer, who doesn't know all of these guys? And there was this nutcase, Feynman, right, running around, he was galvanizing the whole conference. I didn't know it. My family didn't tell me about this. So they took over the hotel, and I sat in on this thing, and there were about 70 scientists there, everybody but Einstein and Fermi. They were the only two missing. Einstein refused to go, and Fermi apparently took off and got lost. We never found out what happened then. But I became aware of Richard Feynman. Feynman took the blackboard and the chalk, and he put the equations down for quantum electrodynamics. And everybody was looking at him as though they had never seen the guy before. And Julian Schwanger, all of the guys that worked with him at Cornell and those places, suddenly being privy to that was an extraordinary experience for me. And then the following week, what happens? Einstein shows up. He pulls up in his boat. You know, he lived out on Long Island. And he came over, and my father, and he was a close friend of my father's. They would sit at the end of the bar and talk, and I have no idea what the hell they were talking about. My father had no education. He came from Greece when he was 15. What was Einstein talking to? It was intense for an hour. It must have been politics. I don't know what they were talking about. But that galvanized me. So I began to study particle physics, and I stumbled into it through the back door. I started looking at numerology first, looking at ancient arithmetic systems that are no longer, being used today. Only magicians use them, you know. So I found that they applied. They applied. Wherever you use them, they applied it. They sounded quantum. And I got involved, and I'm still working on that stuff today, but now it's spread to the Parthenon. I've gone back to the source of where all this stuff came from. So Chris Arabagis and I, he's over at the Resource Center at Pratt, we've been working for 3 years on the Parthenon, day and night. And we're about to publish that.
So, Bill, before we do the Parthenon, let's go back to the particle physics. And, of course, it would be better if this were visual. But what are your insights from these ancient mathematics about? How does that lead to insights to particle physics?
Well, the standard model, you know, that essentially was worked out by Gell-Mann and another guy, even Zweig worked on it, grew like Topsy. In other words, they found the delta resonance, which was made up of up and down quarks. And in the beginning, they thought that's all you needed, just up and down. Then suddenly strangeness slipped in, anti-strangeness. Then they realized, wait a minute, you don't have a linear world. You've got a planar world. You've got a triangle. Then somebody came up with charm. Now you've got a tetrahedron. Now, so it grew like Topsy. Then they went into the fifth dimension. Well, now that's interesting because, according to the Euler 6, string theory can't work. It's dead in the water because it can never account for the top quark. Because there's no way that, how it is six generals at six brigades getting six medals. Nobody's going to wind up, somebody's going to wind up not getting the medals. And that's the top quark. So that sort of thing can paralyze physics for a while. So we've gotten deeply involved into a number system that applies to the Parthenon perfectly. But of course, it's not going to be immediately accepted, primarily because we have no knowledge that they ever knew anything about the meter. And we keep talking about the Parthenon and meters. So you have to account for this coincidence, that how could they have invented a number system that coincides perfectly with the meter but had nothing to do with the meter? Because they couldn't have known that. But they did know what they needed to know in order to put up this perfect place.
Cool. So getting back to architecture from the Parthenon, I opened by giving a very brief description of your idea of organics in architecture. So tell us more about what an organics world would be like.
Well, now, the problem is I've been nickel and diming the dollar for years. If I had been, asking for enough money, I would have gotten support. But my problem is I'm very frugal. I like to do the most with the least. And consequently, that has stymied a lot of the stuff I'm doing. So I've taken a step back into liquid architecture from organic architecture. In order to be able to do it.
In other words, it's cheaper to build with water.
Yes, and it's easy to do. I mean, there are, of course, water is treacherous. I met one of Fry Otto's engineers years ago when he came to my studio, and I said, "Well, why don't we collaborate? You've cornered the world on air and inflation, and I've done the same thing with water." And they said, "Are you crazy?" He said, "We can't control air, and you think we're going to control water?" So that's my problem. We're dealing with a very difficult medium, but it doesn't cost anything.
Cool. So we'll get back to that in a minute, and let's just get caught up. This is John LaBelle. You're listening to Visionaries. We're here on PRN-FM every Monday at 10 a.m., and if you're not free to listen at that time, And I've got just beginning to realize this changing world, you know, like we're not on broadcast radio, but who needs broadcast radio? You dial into PRN FM on your phone, plug it into your car radio, and you're listening on your car radio. And if you're not available to do that at 10 a.m., we're in the PRN archives. So all you have to do is go to visionaries.podbean.com. visionaries.podbean.com. And there you'll find our back shows. Some of them include John David Ebert, a colleague of mine who's a culture and media critic. And his latest books are a series called Scene by Scene, where he analyzes scene-by-scene movies like Star Wars, Apocalypse Now, The Shining, etc. So if you're, you know, like to go in depth, I just recently watched Apocalypse Now again, but before doing so, read Ebert scene-by-scene and then reread Conrad's Heart of Darkness. So you know, you can sort of get immersed in this stuff. On our October 10th show, we talked about technological optimism and how, you know, maybe the world's going to be much more different than we thought it might be. On October 3rd, we interviewed Natasha Vita Moore. So I guess I've friended her on Facebook. So when she pops up, I just went to a conference or I, you know, just released this video. So it's really cool how we can stay in touch with people that way. She's a transhumanist, talks about rebuilding her body, rebuilding what it means to be a human being. You find more about her at natasha.cc. On 9/26, we interviewed Bob Walter about Joseph Campbell. We played some of Joseph Campbell's tapes. And then a bit before that, we interviewed Louis Arana, who is an artificial intelligence engineer. And if you follow him on Facebook, you find he was just hired by a Japanese robotics company to do all the AI for their robots. So what kind of cool world do we live in? So those are the kinds of things going on in our world we try to keep you up to date with on Visionaries. And again, that's visionaries.podbean.com. And my name is John Lobel. I'm professor of architecture at Pratt Institute, author of the book, guess what? Visionary Creativity, How New Worlds Are Born. You can find it on Amazon, barnesandnoble.com, etc. I blog at visionarycreativity.com. And you can find out more about me at johnlobel.com. And find my lectures on YouTube. Just search on John Lobel. Also, I'm actually paying Pratt students to tutor me on what the hell do you do with Facebook and Twitter? What are those about? So you can follow me on Twitter and friend me on Facebook, I think, if I ever figure out how those things work. Our guest today is Bill Katavalis, professor in the School of Architecture, Pratt Institute in Brooklyn. He's an innovative futurist, designer, architect, and teacher, and one of the most imaginative minds of our time. And his work and thinking range from chairs in the New York Museum of Modern Art to 240-mile-tall buildings, from furniture made from chemicals with memory to buildings made from water, and to a reimagining subatomic particles. So, Bill, back to liquid architecture. How do you build with water? Doesn't it just all fall into a puddle?
No. The thing is, you know, if you put water in a glass and put a membrane over the top of the glass and turn it upside down, the water doesn't go anywhere. It's at less than atmospheric pressure. Well, this really, you know, that right there, that is what we're doing now.
I just filling with my water bottle here, but I don't want it to end up all over the floor.
It's the easiest thing in the world to do, but it's also the most difficult because water is you know, what's it, 64 pounds a cubic foot? So we are raising water between plastic bags and creating hydrodomes, hydrowatches, hydrovaults, hydrowalls. We've gone further now.
So you know, let me just interrupt. If anybody wants to see this, contact me. We can go down to the basement of the architecture school at Pratt, and Bill turns on the vacuum machine and the water starts rising up into the structure.
No, it's wonderful because, you know, mass, you know, Corbusier said the architecture must have mass, space, and surface. Well, that's what we've got. We have the liquefaction of mass, the gasification of space, and the solidification of surface. So we're still doing what Corbusier did, only we're doing it in a new way. We're not cutting this stuff, carrying it, or quarrying it, or we're getting it from the site. So it has to be the next step. I mean, Bilbao, Gary's great building, is a joy, but it doesn't make a good cup of coffee. And that bothers me. It doesn't bother him, but it bothers me. I read, you know, Bucky Fuller, if you asked him about a building, he would say, what does it weigh? I feel the same way. What does it do? Does it provide food? Does it provide sustenance? Forget about sustainability. Is it substantiality is the new word? Can it provide everything we need? Of course it can.
So if you're paying these days, when I talked to my student years ago, I would say $100,000. But these days, if you're paying $1 million for a house, which is what they seem to cost, and then it expects you to support it, it should be supporting you.
That's right.
So all
That's
the
right.
waste material should go down to the basement to feed algae, to feed the brine shrimp, to feed the fish, which are automatically prepared and put into the freezer. And so you just, you know, have a fish dinner that the house made for you. You shouldn't have to go out to a grocery store and pay money to bring stuff back to your house.
It's exactly the opposite. I mean, the only way you can grow fish today is if you've got cheap fish food. And cheap fish food is algae. If you're not creating tons of algae, and we're doing it in a new way, not in plastic bags, these bioreactors create tons of algae. That means you can supply the fish that you need, but what's left over becomes biofuel. You've got everything that you need. You've got hydroponics, aeroponics. You've got greenhouses above you. The Clivus multrum is part of the house. If you're getting off the grid, you've got to cut the cord. You've got to handle your own waste product. You've got to handle your own security. You have to handle everything yourself. That's what we're trying to do. The best way to do it is on the hillsides, south-facing hillsides of America. The biggest project in the history of the world has been Eisenhower's Interstate Highway. It's bigger than the China Wall. And yet we've done very little with it. There are thousands of miles of south-facing hills that you have to have a diagonal to get solar energy, and you have to face the sun directly. You have to live that way. You have to use the hydraulic head advantage from that. You've got to store all of the rain. Well, you know, one rainstorm on an acre of architecture is 27,000 gallons of water that you can store and turn into algae. Well, we're doing all that, but the thing is, we have no funding. We're nickel and diming the world. And I'm hearing about all these researchers that are costing millions. Well, you know, if the MacArthur Fund would give us, you know, $250, I would take it to do what I'm doing. I don't need $1 million. What the hell am I going to do with $1 million? And what do they do with $1 million? They're not going to do anything after they get it.
So we should start an online funding for the guests on this show
who are doing these
mind-blowing projects. And let's go back to the water architecture in a little while and talk about the various places where you've taught and what has been and continues to be your experience teaching. What do you see in students, you know, in the 50s versus today? How do you respond to teaching?
Well, Again, the the teachers in the 50s were phenomenal. They really were good. They were good teachers. The ones that went through the war had a lot to think about and a lot to say. And the students of that period turned out fine. Then we flattened out. We flattened out for a while. And I would say what's happening now, even though I'm not a part of it, when I follow the antics of these kids on, BitTorrents and Twitter, and I began to wonder in the early days, what's this all about? But then, in a way, I've been talking about this for years. I mean, they're creating a tapestry that is going to unite the world. I mean, they're on the right track. They're doing all of the right things, and they're very good students. Now, they're the antidote to the 60s. You remember, we were in the 60s. You remember, we were a bunch of slobs. I mean, we were all over the place. We were burning things down. These kids are the exact opposite. They're impeccably dressed. They do what you tell them to do. They're they're geniuses on the computers. That's a different generation. Now, the question is it going to work? Is it all going to work? Is it all going to come together? Or are we going to find that the Middle East is going to go on forever and around the planet? But I believe in that stuff now. I think they're doing the right stuff. I don't have to get involved. But I've been talking about it for years, and I'm glad it's happening.
Cool. Do you find, I hope it's become apparent to our audience here, excuse me, that Bill is a lateral free associative thinker and quite imaginative. Do you find the students less imaginative than they might be, and what do you think is?
No doubt about it. They're much less imaginative, and probably for good reasons. They're frightened by the future. They don't know. I mean, they're properly prepared, but they don't know if it's going to happen. They're worried, and for good reasons. All of this may not happen the way we think it should. So I would say we're living in troubled times. In a way, they're building a bridge over troubled waters, but we're going to have to wait and see if it works.
Right. So let's go back to some of your experiences in the design world of the past. You once told a story about working with foam and its filling up an entire loft. What kind of work were you doing in those days?
Now that was Phil Pavia's studio on Great Jones Street. It's a huge studio. And we were paying about $40 a month for it.
So there's something to ring a bell for our, I've been dealing with design and architectural professionals in Manhattan recently, and they're so crushed by the rents they pay. And, even in inflationary terms, $40 a month for a loft. Cool.
No, really. What happened is that we were working with the Germans. They were sending us all kinds of foam. We were trying to find out whether we could predetermine the shapes that would take. Growing in architecture, we would grow one after another. That's when Drexler came over from the Museum of Modern Art and saw what we were doing, and decided to have a visionary architecture show at the museum. And that was one of the best shows they've ever had. But they've never recorded it. There was no book. There was no evidence that it ever happened. Drexler was very unhappy about that.
What happened with the foam?
One of the interesting things was that they raised the rent. A young woman, a photographer, moved in below, and suddenly Great Jones became a very stylish place. And the rent went up to about $300 or $400. I decided to blow up a bunch of weather balloons and stuff for the studio with it. And then we poured can A and then can B that the Germans gave us, and we went out on the fire escape to talk, and nothing was happening, and then all of a sudden it happened. The foam came up and solidly filled the room. And then we broke in, and these glassine surfaces you get are just gorgeous. So we cut our way from one bloom to another, and we had a ball. We finished the booze, and we left.
So the landlord had to cut out all the foam.
He probably had to torch the whole building. I don't know.
My guest is Bill Katavalos, futurist designer, which would be the shortest way to put it, and imaginative mind. And so, Bill, we both teach at Pratt Institute. You've been there longer than I have, because you were a student there in the 40s.
Yeah, I'm 54, I started.
You know. Oh, you started?
I'm 54.
Oh, 54.
Yeah.
So tell us what your take is on Pratt Institute and how you've seen it change over the decades.
Well, now, when I first went, my brother studied architecture at Pratt. So I visited Pratt back in the late 30s. It was a great school. It was a three-year program, but they had a close collaboration with the engineering school next door. Now, all of the guys in my brother's class made it. They all went to Ketchum, Janay and Sharp, and Harris, Fulio and Harrison. They all became very important architects. Joe Amisano and Trefison, and my brother built all over the world. I mean, he was another Hemingway. He went wherever he could hunt. And but now Pratt, then it became legal. During the war, standards were raised very high. When I came back, it was a four-year program. Then it went to five. All of the schools had changed by that time. But during the war, it had an excellent camouflage courses going on that we all took. And most of the professors went into the war as first lieutenants, because they understood camouflage. Even though Picasso and Braque invented it, we were performing it. So the school was very exciting in those days. I don't want you to get the idea that it was. Then it went into a... The only bright moment was when, Jake Landau said, I mean, I was responsible for it, but I did give Chris Jane, the dean, a paper before I took time off to start Parsons. And I told him what to do. I told him, you know, you've got all these artists downtown, all the guys I used to hang out with, they all want to teach. Why don't you bring those guys up here? Why don't you just stuff the school with the cutting edge? You know, guys like Jim Brooks and Twerkoff, and all, they were all available. Doug Moore, they all came. And I think that John Pei and Jake Landau ran a gorgeous program there for a while. It was the most exciting thing anyways. Then suddenly it just disappeared. And again, we went into the doldrums. Ilchman, I've known all the presidents. Jerry Pratt was a lot of fun. Jerry Pratt liked what I was doing. In fact, I almost drowned him a couple of times in the experiments. But he was followed by Ilchman, who was an academic, you know, who couldn't raise money. He was a delightful guy. His wife was raising more money for Sarah Lawrence than he was for Pratt. Then along came Tom Schutte, who was ideal for Pratt. He has transformed this place. I mean, he's transformed the campus. He's transformed the neighborhood. And he's transformed the way we work. He has been a very successful person.
Cool.
Yeah.
So what did you teach at Parsons, and how was that different?
Design correlation.
So what's design correlation?
Well, what happened when I was in high school, I used to go up to Minton's up in Harlem. I was going around with a black girl at that time, and she knew all what was going on. She used to drag me up, and I would sit in on all these early sessions. But one of my trips when I was walking up there, I stumbled into Columbia, and I got involved with Kiesler. He was running a strange course called biocorrelation. And I sat in on it, and it was fascinating.
So let me interrupt. Kiesler, for architects, we know him for one building called The Endless House.
The Endless House.
So it's sort of like a 3D Moebius strip that you could run your finger around the house and it would never come to an edge. It's always continuous.
It's an endless container. The only thing it contains is the vanishing point of perspective. It ended perspective forever. So I love Kiesler, and I decided to turn that into the design correlation department at Parsons, and I took his techniques of standard models and transformations and variations and mutations, and we developed a bunch of students over there who were extraordinary. But it ran smack into the reality of standard stuff.
So what would go on in a design correlations course that you can talk about on the radio?
Well, again, it was pretty dangerous stuff. I never took LSD, but certainly a lot of the students experimented with it. Leary and all of those folks. The guy that influenced me the most was what's his name, who started flotation. He was talking to the porpoises down there.
Trying to think. One of those new age.
Yeah, he was a delightful guy and a friend of John Vassar, so we got very close. And I learned an awful lot from him and from Leary and all of those guys. And we put a lot of that, we got into biofeedback very heavy. I mean, I used to wire myself at night. I mean, I could work with alpha, beta, even the gamma we're talking about today, and theta. Oh, this was the real stuff. I tried to introduce it at Pratt, but the students, they simply can't do it anymore. They don't believe in that world anymore, and probably for good reasons. But I think it would do them a lot of good to float. It'd be very good for them to cut the appendages for 1 hour, you know, a week.
So there was this moment in the 60s when there's all this wild stuff going on, whether it was psychedelics or, as you described,
it was all good stuff.
Communicating with porpoises or other states of mind.
Right.
And some academics, like Bill, were bringing it into the colleges and integrating it with their courses. And so one of the lacks today is failure to do that even with today's technology. So there are people out there like Ray Kurzweil and Stephen Wolfram, whoever one's favorites might be, and we're failing to bring their ideas into academic circles. And then we're doing something to the students so that they, I think what it is that the schools are raising their standards. And as they get higher SATs, smarter students, but for students to perform like that, they have to keep their professors happy. You don't tell your professor they're an idiot and get a good grade. So we're weeding out the imaginative, rebellious students, and then we wonder why they're all sheep. And so there are things that I'll mention something, you know, in one of my classes. And here the students are sitting there, whether it's with a laptop or a tablet or a phone. They could instantly go to Google and see what, you know, look it up. So, and they don't. They don't have that imaginative spark. So it's, you know, one of Bill's and my complaints about school today. But while we're at it, you also taught at Sarah Lawrence. What was that like? What was Sarah Lawrence all about, and what did you do there?
Well, I was invited up to Sarah Lawrence to help create a design department up there.
Oh, cool.
I don't remember the man, I've forgotten his name.
The president. Taylor?
Yeah. He was with Gregory Taylor, the other Taylor. Gregory Taylor runs
the St. Ritz.
I brought Edgar Kaufman up with me. I mean, and we started a design school, as I recall. And
just to make a connection for our audience, Edgar Kaufman had been educated at Frank Lloyd Wright's, he didn't like to call it a school, but apprenticeship. And then he was jog captain on Falling Water and Johnson Wax. So, and then he was a New York architect. Quite an interesting character.
Well, no, Edgar, you know, I would, with Edgar, I like Edgar, and I like the people that he hung out with. But he invited me up to analyze Falling Water one time. I'm probably the only one who's ever really slept there. I spent the whole weekend there illegally. They allowed me to do it, but the conservancy was man. But I measured the place, and we're still analyzing Falling Water. It's nothing more than De Morgan's Law. It's a perfect example of Froebel blocks. Wright never left his blocks alone, never. I mean, even when he was when he's just about to die, he was still playing with his blocks. And all of his buildings are based on those blocks. The mathematics that comes out of it is, of course, mixes with, you know, De Morgan was Ada Lovelace's teacher. She's the one who wrote the first program for computers today. And she studied with him, and she criticized him. So she was quite a girl.
So back to Sarah Lawrence. What was that all about when you were there?
Well, first of all, they were the daughters of all of the great architects.
So at the time, Sarah Lawrence was a girl's school.
Yeah, no, we had Stonerhoff's daughter, we had Ed Bacon's daughter, we had Tasha, we had Elliot Noyes' daughter. All of the great architects had their daughters at Sarah Lawrence at that time. So it was a wonderful time to be there. They were all terribly intelligent, and they'd been everywhere twice, all of them. So it was a joy to teach them, and they quickly went through biocorrelations. They caught on to it almost automatically.
So what's biocorrelations?
Well, that was taking Kiesler's philosophy and turning it into a new discipline. And the thing I missed the most is all those kids could draw at the speed of light. I used to take them to conferences, and they would draw what the people were saying as they said it. And this was extraordinary. You know, J.J. Gordon was doing senection, and Bud de Bono was doing lateral thinking. Well, we were actually, we got a grant who's the Band-Aid company?
Johnson
& Johnson. Yeah. They gave us a grant to study birth. So we went to all of the hospitals, the students were allowed. We went in, we watched birth, we got involved with birth, we studied birth. And you've even taken one of my quotations in your latest book about birth. We were deeply immersed in that, and we learned an awful lot from it. But it's dangerous, because we were on the edge of... We were on the edge of psychiatry and on the edge of where doctors left off, when quarks become quacks. I mean,
Bill, you want to tell us the story about the fetus and the sustainability?
Or
should I do that?
No, you do it. You do it. I'd like to hear it.
One encounters these great teachers in one's life, and they sort of come together to form a way of thinking. So for me, Bill's one of them. Ed Bacon is one of them. Robert Venturi is one of them. So, and there are these points of view that we get from our teachers, and then specific anecdotes. So we today are in various crises of sustainability, population explosions and population bombs and limits to growth and all that. And I'm quite familiar with that material, and I've used the book Limits to Growth in my teaching. But Bill tells a story of a fetus in a womb, and we've got to make up around 2 or 3 months it comes to consciousness, and it's real happy in its environment, and it's having a good time, and all of its needs are being fulfilled by its environment. But around the third, fourth month, it notices something that it's growing. And by the fifth month, it's checked it out and it realizes it's growing exponentially. So it's doubling every, certain period of time. and it realizes this can very quickly get out of control here. And so it does some, sends out some sonar and, you know, determines the stretchability of its environment, what's beyond the walls of its environment, and it really looks like it's in serious trouble. This is not sustainable. This isn't going to work. We're going to be knee-deep in waste products and bursting our environmental boundaries here. And it goes on a massive sustainability diet, tries to stop growing, starts to do research on how it can recycle its waste, all the time not realizing that in the ninth month, it's going to be in a totally different environment. And so the question is, should we today be preparing ourselves for this crowded little world that we're imagine that we're stuck in, or should we be thinking of what lies beyond it and what are the other possibilities after the ninth month? So that was that great story I got from Bill. I hope I didn't screw it up too much.
No, it sounded better than I said it the first time. I think we're coming to a not the singularity that Kurzweil was talking about. I mean, that's too advanced for me. But we are coming to the end of the oil age. We're gonna fusion will occur when it's absolutely necessary. We can't do it yet because we're not in that much trouble yet. We still have a lot of oil left, and oil is still. But at some point, oil has to be kept for food. We're going to need it for the future, and it can't be used for pushing cars around. The electric car is next, but fusion will occur in about 20 or 30 years. It'll have to. So the age of fusion will pull us back together again. I think confusion we're in right now. We're in the age of confusion. And we have to get our act together. The world has to get its act together. The religions, the Abrahamic religions have got to get together. The Indian, the Chinese, all of that has to become one. Campbell was right. Campbell was a scout. He was a scout for what's going to happen next. It has to happen. It has to happen. You can't get rid of religion. It's just that we have to find a way of. To live with each other in a new way. And I think it's going to happen. I see it happening all over the place.
Cool. Yeah. So we have a few more minutes, and apologies to our audience for not taking phone calls. We'll start to do that in the future. This is John LaBelle. Our show is Visionaries. We're here every Monday at 10 a.m., and if you miss us at that time, just go to the Progressive Radio Network archives, which you'll find at visionaries.podbean.com, the archives for this show. You'll find all our back shows. You can find out more about me at johnlabelle.com. All my background material, I've tried to put PDFs of my books and stuff on there. I blog at visionarycreativity.com, and you can follow me on Twitter and Facebook if I ever figure out what I'm supposed to be doing there. Our guest today, and we'll be wrapping up in a few minutes, is Bill Katavalis, a futurist designer, visionary, teacher, and one of the most imaginative people at our time. So, Bill, in our last minutes, what are you thinking about that none of the rest of us are thinking about? What's up and coming?
At the moment, John, I'm looking at a graveyard in Brooklyn. It's about a circular mile. It's a beautiful graveyard. I'm designing a half-mile-high circular suspension bridge that we can hang the buildings from over the cemetery. When you look around, all the valuable land is cemeteries in New York and Queens, and apparently we've got to do something right away. I think we should transform, and I think we've got to raise the dead. We've got to become interested in those who died. What we need is a BitTorrent about the dead. Who were they? What did they do? We know, we should know more about these people. We should reawaken them, or you know, bring them out. I think we should start a Ted Dead program and do what they're doing with their own Twitters and torrences. Let's raise the dead and celebrate them. Let's talk about them again. Let's bring them back.
Cool. We would have online bios and portfolios and talks by everybody, and we can create a whole online world of these.
All the things that they did, we don't know about. You know, we should. I would like to take one of the books from the dead and perform it on Broadway without even looking at it to see what would happen. Let's do it.
Cool. Well, there's one. So we make this giant suspension building and half mile high, and then we could put whole cities hanging from there.
You could. I mean, yeah, you could turn Brooklyn into Prospect Park if you wanted to. You know, that's
cool.
Right? It's a coming place, and you have gorgeous views of Manhattan.
Cool. Anything else that we should be knowing about? What else are you working on?
Well, again, it's my interest in the Parthenon and particle physics. They occupy an awful lot of time.
So the Parthenon, particle physics, and liquid architecture.
Yes, and graveyards.
And just so people can get oriented, let me embarrass Bill. Bill, how old are you? When were you born?
92, I think.
You're 92. So that, you know, it's time for some of the younger people to challenge us with imaginations. Why is it the older people that are thinking about these things? We need some more from our students and from our younger colleagues. Cool. Well, my guest has been Bill Katavalis, designer, futurist, professor at Pratt Institute. My name's John Lobel, and this is PRN.FM. Find us every Monday at 10 a.m. and go to visionaries.podbean.com to see our back shows.